For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Yeah, patriarchy or serving love? That's the question before us here. Yeah, context. If you were here last week, we saw this as a group of believers in the Greco-Roman culture that was under persecution. It's abundantly clear throughout the book they're being persecuted. And a lot of what Peter's writing to them about is counsel for how to behave in a situation where you're in constant danger and from the hostility of the community you're in. Part of his advice was to keep your head down, keep from attracting undue attention, hostile attention, by flaunting their social expectations, even when those expectations are invalid and are not in line with biblical teaching. Just go along with it anyway, because it's we can't expect to change everything in one swoop. And so based on this, he had told them in chapter 2 to honor all people. Submit to the king. Submit to the governor. The government. He says, slaves, you better submit to your masters. Yeah, that too. And we saw in other passages that Paul is anti-slavery. He believed that it was that humans should not be the slaves of men, because we are the slaves of God. He's our master. And in the same context, then, wives need to submit to their husbands. See, right there in the first phrase, in the same way. So this chapter break here absolutely does not belong. And those were put in hundreds of years later, of course. That's not a part of the text. Peter's thought is unbroken here. He's going through and basically showing everyone that has expectations socially placed upon them needs to just comply with that in order to keep some of the very, very real danger that they're in from coming down on them. He says, you wives must accept the authority of your husbands. Then, if some refuse to obey the good news, your godly lives will speak to them without any words, and they will be won over by observing your pure and reverent lives. So he says, for women, it's a good idea basically to try witnessing to your husbands through your works. And what's anticipated here, and the NLT doesn't bring it forward, but as clearly, even if some of you, says you need to submit your wife, including those who are bad, who are bad husbands, unreasonable, non-believers, refusing to listen to the gospel. So here you have a Christian wife married to a non-Christian husband. It's a dangerous situation. I'd like to read some comments to you tonight from Karen Jobes, who is an expert on the book of Hebrews, or 1 Peter, and on the first century culture. She points out, why would wife's conversion likely provoke antagonism from her husband? In Greco-Roman society, it was expected the wife would have no friends of her own and would worship the gods of her husband. That's a social expectation they had. First, the very fact that a woman would adopt any religion other than her husband's violated the Greco-Roman ideal of an orderly home. A husband, the father, in a patriarchal culture like this, where their family is under the nomine patrie, the law of the father, runs the home. And here you got your wife going out to some crazy new cult in town. You're a loser, and you're a weakling. You need to get that woman under control. This was their attitude. Jobs goes on, because prosperity and well-being were seen as dependent on religious forces, disorder in the home was a threat, not only to the family, but to the society. She points out how Christians were frequently blamed as the cause of public calamity, because they had introduced a new god, upsetting the religious status quo of the empire. There's many abundant examples of this. She cites off a bunch of them. There would be a plague, you know, a flu might come into a town, and people are getting sick, and they'd be like, it's those, you know, they always had some religious explanation for it. The rains aren't coming. We're having a drought. It's bound to happen. They've pissed off the gods. It's those Christians. And so persecution would come down. It's all the excuse people needed. The husband and society would perceive the wife's worship of Jesus Christ as rebellion against her husband. And especially if she worshiped Christ exclusively. Oh, now there's the point right there. See, it's not just that a husband would be like, I like this new God, Jesus, too. And he'd be like, fine with that. But if she's going to say, yeah, but he's the only one. All of these others, Zeus, Hermes, Aphrodite, they're false gods. They're not real. That is really over the line, just like it is today. Nothing has changed. It's like if you want to do a Jesus thing, fine, suit yourself. As long as you don't challenge the gods of our era, materialism, careerism, unqualified, individualistic freedom. You know, if you start to infringe on any of the things that we in our culture really view as you know, deity, then all hell is going to come down on you at that point. And so this was certainly happening in their cities that they were in. If the wife persisted in her new religion to the extent that others outside the household learned of it, the husband would also feel embarrassment and suffer criticism for not properly managing his household. This could seriously damage his social standing, even to the point of disqualifying him for certain honors and offices. There'd be a lot of men in this situation ready to come down hard on that wife. And boy, they were empowered to do that. The men had all the power in this culture. He could dismiss her from the marriage and keep her children, put her out on the street. And there was nothing she could do about it. No court of appeal whatsoever. Or he could throw her out with her children and not a cent of child support or anything, and she would be out, unable to get a career, with children to take care for, of, and no way to pay her bills. It was life-threatening, literally. An ancient husband could beat his wife, could whip her, and that was permissible as well. This was really a dangerous situation. This woman has come to know the true God in her heart. She knows that it's true, that God is real. She's had the Spirit of God enter her. She's not willing to give that up. She shouldn't be. And yet, she's married to a guy who's like, no way. Absolutely not. She's really in a tough spot. The wife's attendance at Christian worship would provide the opportunity for her to have fellowship with other Christians who possibly were not her husband's friends. That is considered very suspicious. Right there. You're going down to what? And you're going to be sitting around talking with other men there? It's just not permissible. That's totally uncool. Peter's concern that Christian wives continue to submit to their own husbands not only shields the Christian community from accusation that it's a social evil, but is also clearly motivated by evangelistic intent. You know, as a Christian wife with a non-Christian husband, what's your goal? It's to win that man. You need to win him to Christ. And that is first and foremost. And we have this still today all the time. It could be a wife that comes to Christ and not the husband. It could be a husband and not a wife. And the whole church has to realize we've got to go talk to that spouse. And there's a serious contradiction here. The two are become one in marriage, and yet one of them is following God, the other one is not. This is headed for trouble. And so, obviously, we want to try to win. If it's a guy that's not a believer, we try to win him. The unbelieving husband observes virtues in the wife's good demeanor that are motivated by her relationship with Christ. The man himself may be won to Christ without words, quote unquote, for in that culture, it's shameful for the wife to presume to instruct her husband. Of course, I'm sure she's already told him what she's into and so forth, but then he's basically saying, now you need to fall quiet and start speaking with your deeds. Here is a situation, she says, where silence is the more effective means of communication. that they would be won over without a word, not even have to say anything. And so we see this happen today still. And I spent about 15 years doing ministry in adult home churches. And this would happen all the time. I mean, how often is a man and a woman going to come to Christ at the same time? It's pretty rare. Almost always you have one of them comes to Christ. The other one either isn't coming around, isn't interested at all, or maybe has come around and listened but is dragging their feet. They're not sure they're into it. And so this very situation comes up. Now, if you get a wife, I know more about the wives with husbands, and frankly, it's more often that's what happens. I don't know whether that's our culture or what. If she goes home, she's and, you know, is trying to bear down on him, it's like the worst thing she can do. It is the worst thing she can do. Exactly what she didn't want him to think. What she should be doing is coming home. She should come home more loving, more accepting, warmer, and you know, agreeable after she goes to Bible study than any other time of the week. That's how to win that man over. He's going to be like, I like what this is doing to you. Go to him, check it out. Did I do that? Verse 3. Don't be concerned about outward beauty of fancy hairstyles, expensive jewelry, or beautiful clothes. You should clothe yourself instead with the beauty that comes from within. The unfading beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is so precious to God. Inner beauty. Karen Jobes goes on, their beauty is to be the inner quality of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is of great worth in God's sight, and not the costly adornment of elaborate hairstyles, fine clothing, and gold jewelry, which are, of course, of great worth in society's sight. And she goes on, that Peter's instructions against outward adornment make sense if a Christian wife is attending Christian worship outside of her home, and especially if doing so without her husband. She's going to get all prettied up to go down to this thing where there's other men. Super suspicious. Society would perceive that act of going down there alone as questionable. By leaving her home unadorned, her intent to attend worship and not a tryst sex affair would presumably be all the more clear. So that makes a lot of sense in that context, doesn't it? Yeah, clothing yourself with the inner beauty. It's the inner beauty. And this was also a stress not only in the New Testament, but you see it as a stress in the Old Testament, where the Proverbs teach that, you know, beauty, charm is deceptive, beauty is fleeting. But a woman who fears God is greatly to be praised. It's a godly woman is the most desirable thing. And he goes on, this is how the holy women of old made themselves beautiful. They trusted God and accepted the authority of their husbands. For instance, Sarah obeyed her husband Abraham and called him Lord. You are her daughters when you do what is right without fear of what your husbands might do. Okay, so you have the example of women in the Old Testament who were, you know, submissive, which basically means cooperative, agreeable with their husbands. And Sarah is being cited as one here, but we have a major issue, I think, right here where she called him Lord. Good Lord. First of all, there is no example where she would not say "Hi, Lord" to her husband at all. This is apparently alluding to an event that happened in Genesis 18, when she, by herself in her tent, musing to herself, refers to him as her master, her Lord. The word Adonai. Which could be used for God, but also used of humans, kind of like the British talk about the House of Lords. We really have no English equivalent. Either we have no word that matches this or concept. We just don't have anything like this. I was trying to think of how this really should be translated, and this is the problem. We don't do this anymore. A wife would never call her husband Lord in our culture, or master, either one. I mean, those would be totally inappropriate for Christian wives as well as non-Christian. Nobody basically uses this. This is a Semitic usage. She's basically referring to her husband in a respectful term. It's not as weird sounding as Lord sounds in English. That's really just doesn't get the job done. And there are idioms like this that just can't be easily translated, and this is one of them. Also, the fact that this is not spoken to him, she says it about him when she's musing to God. Will I now, you know, have a child when I'm so old and my master or my whatever husband is also old? And also the verb to obey is not used of Sarah. In fact, three different times it's used of Abraham heeding, obeying his wife's word. Like when she suggested they have a baby with Hagar, which was not too cool. We do see an example of her complying with what he wants when they lied to Pharaoh, and she was told it was to save his life. So I guess but that's a problem too. Because what he was telling her to do was wrong, it was lying, and God, you know, had to intervene to block it. It was really not a good episode. And so why would Peter point to that and say, there's a good example? It's not a good example. And that's why I don't think he is pointing to that episode. I think she was obviously, you know, left her home with him. She left Ur with him, traveled all the way over to Israel followed him. She was following his leadership, no question about that. But people use that example to try to foster kind of an extreme fundamentalist chauvinism where women should just do whatever their husband tells them, even if it's wrong. And that is never taught in the Bible. Don't forget the cases like, for example, Sapphira in Acts 5, who listened to her husband's plan to scam, to do this con job, and he got cut down, and she got cut down too. Because she went along with it. She's just as guilty as him. The Bible teaches that one never teaches unqualified obedience to any authority. Authority of the state, which is in this context, right? Submitting to the king, submitting to the master, and submitting to the husband. They're all contingent. They're limited. We have to put in the understood as much as possible. Submit to them as much as possible. But of course, there are higher considerations, as we can see from this little cue right here. When you do what is right without fear of what your husbands do. In other words, he's anticipating that some of the things in some areas she's not going to be able to give in to his wishes. He's like, you're not going to worship Jesus Christ anymore, and you're going to go back to the Greek gods like before. She has to be like, can't really do that. And so she has to have the courage to stand up in that case and take whatever he's going to dish out, which could be pretty bad. But if she's submissive and cooperative in every other area, and only is not in this area, it's far less likely that he's going to cut her down or throw her out or something like that. If she does get thrown out, fortunately, of course, she would now, as a believer, have the body of Christ, the community of fellow believers to turn to. And this has happened. This is why you see these programs in New Testament cities where they're feeding the widows. Some of them could easily be divorcees that were rejected from their home, either by parents or spouse, kicked out and had no means of support. And the church, you find them in Ephesus there, and Paul's writing to Timothy about the collection for widows, and also in Jerusalem. The church took care of them because they a woman. Women were not educated. You wouldn't hire a woman to do work, as most of the work was manual labor. You didn't hire women for that. And so a woman without that protection was in a very dangerous position. Verse 7, in the same way you husbands must give honor to your wives. Treat your wife with understanding as you live together. She may be weaker than you are, but she's your equal partner in God's gift of new life. Treat her as you would, as you should, so your prayers will not be hindered. And so here we have, just while the Greco-Roman world believed that wives should be submissive to their husbands and those social expectations that Peter's saying we should go along with, here's something that's completely alien to the Greco-Roman world. Instructions to the husband about how you should treat your wife. In their world, I'll treat her however I want to treat her. Not as a believer, he says. And he says it's crucial, and he's speaking now, of course, to the Christian husbands, since non-Christians wouldn't be reading this. But the Christian husbands are to be an example and a statement to the rest of the city they're in of the values of Christ by the way they treat their wives. Of course, he's using generalizations here. She may be weaker than you, as the weaker vessel, as NESV reads, which is the literal rendering, the weaker vessel. It's referring to the vessel is used several times in the New Testament, possessing your vessel with honor. It's your body. The vessel is the container of the person. You know, like I'm inside the here, my body. My body is my vessel. She's the weaker vessel, meaning that women are physically weaker than men. And this was a big problem, actually, in the ancient world. They often drove their women and made them work hard at labor. The woman had to do all the work around the household and in farm labor as well. They would be driven to labor. Hard. Not helped. The man would be sitting around like a drone, like a king, and let her serve him. And he says, that's wrong. You always hate to see the old slob making his woman work more than him. And they did it a lot.
That's really bad. He's even got the umbrella and the one beer she's got.
I know it's a generalization. Generally speaking, men have more height on average. They have more body weight. They have more physical strength. I know I've gotten in trouble with a couple of feminist friends of mine for daring to say that, but, you know, why do they have women's sports and men's sports then? They're just not them all together. It's like you're not supposed to say it, and it's not always true. There are exceptions. I don't think I want to mess with her. So it's a generalization. But he's calling on her, the guy, to be sympathetic and to help her out around the house, basically, not make her do all the work. Karen Jobs again. Peter directly addresses the general Greco-Roman attitude of the inferiority of women by pointing out that the female is also a co-heir. That's the word here, a fellow. An NLT didn't use the term, but that's what it is in Greek. She's a co-heiress. Heir, an inheritor. An heir of what? A kingdom. The Bible teaches we're all heirs of the kingdom of God. You're living with a princess, soon to be a queen. And so she's to be treated that way. Therefore, he says, she is not excluded from the same privilege of grace enjoyed by the male. As a Christian, her status as a co-heir levels the spiritual ground between the believing husband and the believing wife, opening the door wider to social transformation. It's the same concept we find in the book of Galatians 3, verse 28, where Paul says, "Therefore there is neither Jew nor Gentile, there's neither slave nor free, there is neither male nor female. We're all one in Christ." Jesus, the great equalizer. And so here, Peter teaches that men whose authority runs roughshod over their women, even if it's with society's full approval, which might be the case here, will not be heard by God. Yeah, that part right there. Treat her as you should so your prayers will not be hindered. You know, as a father myself of a daughter, I remember my daughter as a little girl, and I just think of some guy trying to abuse, mistreat her, trying to domineer over her, and that would just fill you with an incredible contempt for anybody that ever tries to do that. And the women in the body of Christ are daughters of God. So, brothers, maybe you should consider that when you're going out with a lady who is God's daughter, when you're marrying and interacting with a lady who's God's daughter, you should consider how he might feel about his daughter. And that might be a good guide to how you should treat her. The well-being of the Christian household, this is Job's again, depends on the man recognizing the female as a co-heir in Christ and living with her respectfully, even though he is the physically stronger and the socially empowered male. Here, Christ is totally countercultural in that regard. How ironic it is, she says, that the words, these words that first century slaves and wives would both have read as affirming and empowering are criticized by some today as enslaving and oppressive. Yeah, that's true. We should think about that a little bit. Because today, feminist scholarship has brought a lot of needed focus onto the concept of patriarchy. Patriarchy is basically the rule of the father. And it's the way traditional cultures have always been and still are. And Western culture also has been this way up until recently. And there's a move away from it, which I think Christians should applaud. The main thrust of patriarchy is defending men's rights to dominate the women around them. I think the biggest source of the patriarchal urge, especially when you see it coming from Christians, is from weak males who lack the security to feel safe around strong women. Something I saw growing up as the son of a strong woman. And watching these weak males shiver around her and try to ban her from speaking and from having influence when, in fact, she was bearing like 100 times the fruit that any one of them were, but never permitted to speak in her own church because the lame males there were too insecure. It really marked me. I never forgot that. Even though I wasn't a Christian at the time, I held those men in contempt. Patriarchy has been prominent in religious history, and unfortunately, one of the forces driving for patriarchy in history has been religion. Religion always pushes for this, it seems like. We think of rabbinic Judaism. We can read the thinking of the rabbis. A man's wickedness is better than a woman's goodness. Women bring shame and disgrace. You see this in just reams of this. These are not unusual citations I'm bringing up here. They're just very typical, and it's typical of what women's studies people refer to as misogyny, hatred of women. It's a bitter, nasty comment to make, not true in any sense of the word. Very unbiblical. Neither Old Testament or New Testament has anything like this. You see what kind of teaching we have in the New Testament. They're co-heirs. They're to be treated with respect. Better the words of Torah, the Old Testament, be burned than that they should be handed over to women. They didn't believe you should ever teach women the word because they're too naive. They're too simple-minded for that. In Islam, no different. It says in the Quran, men are the managers of the affairs of women because God has preferred in bounty one of them over another. Righteous women are therefore obedient, guarding the secret for God's guarding, and those you fear may be rebellious, admonish. Banish them to their couches and beat them. Surah 434, Quran, right there. Beat them. Glad there's nothing in the Bible like that. Hinduism, Carmody and Carmody comment in their book, Ways to the Center, Hindu religious texts frequently imagine woman as a snake, as hell's entrance, death, a prostitute, or an adulteress. In Manu's code, slaying a woman was one of the minor offenses. The birth of a girl was not an occasion for joy. Hindus attributed it to bad karma in a previous life and frequently announced the event by saying nothing was born. It's misogyny. Hatred of women. What is wrong with these people? Why would they be this way? A lot of people are not aware that in Hinduism, women can't go to heaven. What's the best thing that a woman can expect? To be reincarnated as a man. That's the best she can hope for. Men, given the privilege by religious teaching, women suppressed. These are not isolated. I'm just picking a few examples. We could go all night reading texts like this. Now, finally, we come to Christianity. Whew. Finally, a little relief, right? Sorry, ladies. Not to be. Jerome says, as long as a woman is for birth and children, she's as different from man as a body is from a soul. But when she wishes to serve Christ more than the world, then she will cease to be a woman and will be called a man. Yeah, church fathers often portrayed women as unspiritual. John Damascene, women is a wicked she-ass, a hideous tapeworm to the advanced post of hell. Ambrose, a saint, he says, she who does not believe is a woman, and so she's designated by the name of her sex, whereas she who believes progresses to perfect manhood. To the measure of the adulthood of Christ, she then dispenses with the name of her sex. So women are just pictured as this just really low, carnally minded, and unspiritual type of person. And I thought I would bring along a little clip. This girl's named Amanda, and she had the experience of coming from a hardcore feminist perspective to be confronted with the claims of Jesus and the difficulties that she had with that because of her learning, the training that she had had, which made her aware of the intense misogyny and patriarchy in religious traditions, including Christianity. But you also can't believe everything you're told. And a lot of times biblical authors are lumped in here in a way that I think, and she now believes, is unfair.
I majored in women's studies. I graduated from Ohio State University with a degree from the Department of Women's Studies. My background in growing up had a very large effect on how I viewed men and women. Since my mother was a single mom, and my dad and her had gotten divorced at such a, you know, when I was only a few months old, I didn't really grow up with a male figure in my house other than my brother. Men were always absent. When my mom had gotten a boyfriend and had him move in with us, I was probably like, 4 years old. From the time I was four to the time I was like 6 or 7, we lived in a very sexually abusive home. So I had that abuse the dad who left, and the men throughout my life that started the view, started my view on, a poor view on men, especially with just that I thought that they treated women poorly. And I saw how my mom had been like this doting woman who just wanted to care for her children. And I that's when I very much viewed that as weak. Like, I saw her and she was weak, and look how she was treated. I would call myself a Christian feminist. I definitely, my view of feminism has changed over the years. Feminism to me is a lot about equality for people. Being a Christian puts that in such a more beautiful term to me. Like, I think that God is basically had that same idea. You know, he never intended for women to be treated beneath men at all. The women around me in my field of study had a lot of bitterness issues toward what the Bible represented, or what they thought the Bible represented. I know I had a lot of misconceptions, and I thought that that pretty much ran rampant. Our professor actually talked specifically about Paul, and that Paul could be attributed to a lot of the way society had set up discrimination towards women, or the way they had set up how women should be treated. Whether or not that was taken out of context or not was irrelevant. I mean, it was basically, it had been taken, you know, Paul was just noted as being the guy behind. He's basically the father of discrimination for women, I guess. I started wondering if that thing, that was true, you know, was this really true? And I had a very distinct view of the Bible. I had felt that it was a good storybook, even though I really had never read it. I was like fed up. So I'm like, okay, someone's got to sit down and tell me. Is Paul a chauvinist? Is he the father of chauvinism? I think that people were almost shocked. I think people, I frightened people when I first started coming around, because I was so aggressive and very much like, I am woman, hear me roar. But I was just really mad. I mean, I was really mad. I was mad at God. I was mad at Paul. I was mad at everyone. If you were male, I was mad. Well, I had started, when I had started coming to a Tuesday night home church, I was very much like, after the teaching, people would just come up to me and ask me, like, what'd you think? And I was really willing to tell them, you know, this is what I thought. So I would start dialoguing with people, and they would, if they didn't know the answer, they'd come back and tell me, you know, well, I don't know. Let me look at that. Let me look it up. So they come back, and I would make them prove it to me. I had a lot of people who were really willing, and it was almost scarily excited about answering my questions. It actually freaked me out at times, but most of the time I just thought, oh, they're kind of cool. I a lot of my views changed about Paul, you know, the more I researched him. And I started to think that there might be a possibility that he was okay. And I would keep running, you know, Galatians 3:28 through my head over and over and over. There's neither Greek nor Jew, there's neither slave nor free man, there's neither male nor female, for you all one in Christ Jesus. That was a very freeing verse for me. I mean, that was like my call to, you know, my call home from the Lord, you know. Like, I really felt like God was telling me through that verse and through other verses that I had never intended for my word to be used against you. You know, it was never meant to harm you. It is equality, true equality for women. God wants us to treat each other in a loving way. And discriminating against each other is the farthest thing from loving. I had gone to a place eventually where I was accepting of Paul, and I started feeling very much like he was an all right guy. But when it came to marriage, I drew the line. I did not want to hear anything Paul had to say about marriage. When I started to really understand what traits God had put into me, what qualities, characteristics, and that sort of thing, that has now become one of the things that I love. Like, I love the fact that God's made me a nurturer. I love the fact that he's made me more sensitive. I love the fact that, you know, my husband comes to me for that quality. You know, I love the fact that he relies on me to help him where he stops, you know, emotionally. You know, I think it's a great strength, but before I thought, yuck. When you're growing up through life and you think things are off and you just never know exactly what they are or why something's wrong, that is I think a lot of what God offered me was answering those questions. But before God, before I really let God answer those questions for me, I think feminism offered me a way to theorize that and sort of understand it, but it never offered me a solution. It never offered me a way to practice, you know, equality. And I think God, that definitely gives you that. He gives you the whole framework.
Oh, yeah. She's cool. Well, Peter goes on to sum up. All of you should be harmonious, sympathetic, brotherly, kind-hearted, and humble in spirit. Don't repay evil for evil. Don't retaliate with insults when people insult you. Instead, pay them back with a blessing. That is what God has called you to, and He'll bless you for it. And so here we come down to the real issue, right? This theory of power relations, of striving for power that's not our way, competing, seeing who can get the upper hand, who can boss, who can control. As believers, we're into voluntary servitude to humility. To be harmonious, to be sympathetic, brotherly, kind-hearted, and humble in spirit. How do you do that? That takes the Spirit of Jesus Christ coming into your life to get to that point. And so, when you see a group of people actually practicing this, and you watch them together, and you see, man, they are harmonious. They're humble toward each other. They serve each other. There isn't this competition and the put-downs and the smack talk and the jealousies and everything that I see everywhere else I turn. And what is different about these people? And that is potent evidence for the reality of Jesus Christ right there. This is what Peter's concerned about. He's like, if you're going to win through in this city, it's not going to be, you know, you're a minority. You don't retaliate against people. You don't pay evil with evil. Yes, people are going to insult you. You're going to be persecuted. And what you do is you do something good back. You find something serving to do toward that person. You return a blessing for an insult. And what's the result? Is that's how you win your city. That's how you win through with your city. And, you know, person by person, we see it happening. We see person after person just coming around and they're just finding like, I couldn't deny it anymore. What I saw with my own eyes and these people is one of the strongest messages. And Peter says, this is what God's called you to do. And He'll bless you for it. So what we really need to do is get that focus on God and what He's called me to do. Not my husband in the way he's acting, my wife in the way she's acting, those people at work that keep getting on my case, that keep making snide remarks, and so forth. The question is, what is God calling me to do? And if I do that faithfully, He will reward me. And that's really the message. So let's draw a few conclusions. What we've seen here. We've seen that God, the Bible has a high view of women. They're co-heirs. And this is particularly true in believing families, where we should view our women, wives, daughters, sisters this way. It calls definitely for a different approach to marriage, something that is not patriarchy. One of the reasons the world has trouble understanding the biblical view of marriage, the biggest reason, is because they don't understand what servant leadership is. Servant leadership is not dominion. It's not authoritarian. It's the leader is the first to serve, the first to sacrifice what he wants to serve the other. And so when we use the term leadership in the Christian context, we have to remember Jesus' words and the whole framework of teaching on this. where Jesus says that the Gentiles love to lord it over each other, and they're great men that exercise authority over each other. It shall not be so among you. But whoever would be first among you must be last. Whoever would be the leader must be the servant of all. That concept, so deep, so rich, is not understood by the secular mind. The secular mind is the mind of the Gentiles that love to lord it over people. You try to get higher in the company so you can have more people under you. You're not trying to get under people, you're trying to get people under you in the world. And now we come to God's teaching. And this servant leadership concept is so central, and it's not what's taught so much in this passage, so I don't have time to get further into it. But this is why we're able to submit to one another. We're submitting to each other's serving attitude. Definitely, if we have successful marriages today in our world, that's going to be like a bright light in a dark sky, because marriage is in desperate trouble in our world today, and most of us have been from homes. We know all about that part. And so you see a really loving and deep, engaged marriage where people are happy. That's really going to stand out as a bright light, and people are going to be attracted to that. And we see this all the time. Of course, we can all start right now by starting to become the person that's going to be able eventually to participate in that kind of marriage. And it will test us. It will test the flesh. We need to mature spiritually if we hope to be able to pull something like this off. And when we do, then we'll be like the people in Peter City whose way of life is so awesome they can win people over as they won't look on. Let's just draw the line there for tonight. Next week, he's going to talk about, yes, there is relational evidence for the reality of Christ, and also there's other evidence as well, objective evidence. I'd invite you to come back next week, and we're going to just browse through a number of those areas for thinking through, why should I believe this? Anyway, should I believe? Is there any evidence for it?
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.